listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. As of press time Monday, the Tax Reform Act of 2017 was still in reconciliation between the House and Senate, with key provisions still undecided. Nevertheless, the media and politicians on both sides predicted either doom and gloom or, with equal certainty, promises of an economic renaissance. To parse some of this, we spoke with economist Richard Wolff, professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and a visiting professor presently in the graduate program in international affairs of the New School University in New York. We spoke with him via Skype from New York, Monday. Dr. Wolff, it's a pleasure to have you back. It's been much too long.
Thank you, Don. I feel the same way. Okay, let me talk about things that I think are true pretty much no matter which way the negotiations end up. They don't seem to be negotiations or reconciliation that throws into doubt the broad outlines of what is being done here. So let me talk about those. The first, and I think the most important, is that such an act, as it passes, represents another significant major step in the redistribution of wealth and income upward in this economy. In other words, this is Robin Hood in reverse. It takes from the middle and the poor, and it gives to those at the top. This would be bad enough for those of us who care about such things. But it is even more stunning to see such an act happen at the end of a 30-year period during which the same thing was done every year, every other year. I mean, we have seen, for example, the top rate of the personal income tax go from the 90% in the 50s and 60s of the last century, then to 70% in the 70s and into the early 80s. So we now see it at 5 or 39%, depending on how you count it. So we've seen over the last 30 years cuts on the order of 50%, 70%, something for those at the top that nobody else enjoyed. Nobody else enjoyed anything like that kind of a tax cut. Likewise, we have seen over the last 30 years that the corporations of the United States found ways, which the IRS did not take away from them, to escape the 35% formal rate of taxes on corporate profits. They did so by all kinds of exemptions and deductions that they got written into the law. But probably the bulk of the money was simply moved out of the country to tax havens around the world, again, utilizing laws that were passed in that period of time, so that the corporations didn't ever pay 35%. I believe the average was in the neighborhood of 25, 27%, which is roughly what they pay in other parts of the world. But they were also able to go to the Cayman Islands or Ireland or other places where they could escape the taxes. So the big corporations and the rich have had a tax holiday for 30 years, which explains in large part the kind of inequality that has gotten so much worse
And
over the last 30 years.
On that point, let me just ask something, because you know you're talking about basically another round of gouging of the from the bottom. And it's kind of remarkable, because the last 30 years have been fairly thorough in doing that, where we're looking at something like 2/3 to 3/4 of the people don't even have $500 to $1,000 net worth.
Yeah, I mean, for me, that's the grotesquerie. What you seem to now be on is no longer a steady, regular shifting of the inequality. What you now begin to see in this bill is a quantum leaps, that is, an inequality that has gotten so bad that those at the top no longer worry about it. They are in a rush, almost, you could see, to grab it all before it disappears, to use the fact that they have already so much concentrated wealth that they can buy the system, the political system, to get even more, and that's what they could do and should do and must do. And then, by the way, some of them have said this to me, and then when the blowback comes, yeah, they'll lose a third or a half of it, but it will be so big by that time that they'll still be the richest people in the society after that blowback happens. And therefore, not to grab more now, not to have a tax bill like this that gives them even more, would be self-destructive. And therefore, they've worked out in their minds, this is the right thing for them to do. And when you push them, their answer is, this is the right thing to do because we can get away with it.
Mm. Ouch.
For me, this represents a kind of final step in the end of a period of American capitalism coming right out of the Great Depression, in which the prideful point, the best rationalization for capitalism Americans could come up with, was that it created a vast middle class, that it took the mass of the working class, or at least most of it, the white part, the male part especially, and lifted them to a state of middle classedness, which was so wonderful and so historically unique that you should celebrate capitalism for that achievement. That's over. That's gone. This act will be the final brick burying that claim. They're going to have to come up with other things, and they are doing that, because this capitalism produces grotesque inequality, not a vast middle class. You even had the election last year in which all the major candidates promised that they would rescue, save, reassess, redevelop the middle class, and clearly nothing remotely like that has happened or is on the agenda of any significant political force.
It's interesting. I was listening last week to a speech that one of the theoreticians, one might say, of the Trump administration made in Washington, D.C., Steve Bannon, who comes out of Wall Street, out of Goldman Sachs specifically, essentially made the following statements, and unequivocally. Number one, the $4-point-some-odd-trillion weight of the so-called war against terrorism has been a complete, you know, disaster economically. And two, the U.S. military bases around the world, which also operate, you know, the rest of the budget over the last 15 years, I think he used as a basis, were several other trillions of dollars. And the destruction of community banks, savings and loans, and all of that has meant that there's basically no financial, you know, possibilities, no assistance available for reconstructing a middle class. And I'm wondering why, like, the theory that's being spoken, even, you know, in those circles, well, actually, that's about the only place I've heard it, why we're not seeing any policy actualized along those lines at all. I mean, no one's talking about setting up community banks, for example, in, you know, at a policy level.
Well, I think it's without being too mean-spirited, I think it's explained by the same phenomena that mean that Mnuchin and Cohn remain at the White House and Mr. Bannon doesn't. In other words, what Mr. Bannon is good for is the popular, the if I were mean, I'd say fascist, but okay, I can say the attempt to have some framework, some ideas that you can go to this vast middle class and make them believe, if you're good at it, if you work at it, that voting for Republicans is in some way going to help you as a middle of the income distribution person or something like that. And the party needs that. It has always needed that. Otherwise, I mean, what would the Republican Party be? Take a step back. The Republican Party has been always what the Democratic Party is now, namely financially dependent on the folks at the top, either the corporations or the people who become rich because they are shareholders or top executives of those corporations. And the Republicans, therefore, have always had what you might call their Gramsci problem. They represent way too small a slice of the American voters. Mm-hmm. And therefore, if they're going to do the job they have set themselves up to do, namely, provide supports, subsidies, exemptions, and everything else for corporations and the rich, they have got to have a mass base. They got to go find it. So, of course, they will embrace evangelical Christianity if they can cut a deal with them. And Mr. Trump comes along and says, I'm going to give you more than symbols. I'm actually going to give you a bunch of stuff. Great, then you're better than either of the two Bushes or people like that, the traditional people. And Mr. Bannon is the same thing. In his case, it has nothing to do with Christian fundamentalism, whatever he may say. What it's about is this appeal to a kind of popular middle-class self-delusion that this Republican Party, whatever their doubts, is better than the Democrat. It somehow is going to really do something for them. And Bannon correctly knows that doing that, saying that, pushing that, is part of the only way the Republicans can stay in office. My guess is Mr. Bannon, whose main interest seems to be a kind of we can go it alone U.S. nationalism of an old kind that has always existed in the United States, that's his real thing. And he sees the Republican Party as the vehicle. And that means he understands that he has to pay a price. He has to pander to the rich who are at the top because they run the Republican Party. And he has to pander or at least quietly acknowledge the Christian fundamentalists because those are another part of the base. And so he wants them to give him the space, which they're doing, to go run around and say, I, as a leading Republican, promise you up and down that this will happen and that will happen. And look how daring I am. I'm saying that the defense budget is too large and that should be cut back, and the money saved thereby should help you in the middle class. You should be able to get a loan from your local bank. more easily than you have been. You should be given these tax breaks, those tax breaks, and we're working on it, and you should vote for us. The Democrats don't care because they either serve the folks at the top or they serve the folks at the bottom. You are not of interest to them. Therefore, you should go with that. This is a very old gambit, and I think that's what Mr. Bannon is doing.
And that's inside the Republican Party. That's a pretty common, you know, historical mode. You know, looking at that, I mean, and, you know, we're Marxists. I've heard you say it enough about yourself to say that, to call you one. And the reason I bring it up is that as Marxists, when we look at history, we generally try to not look at the, you know, big man, big event, you know, narrative of history, but rather history as, you know, a bunch of social processes, economic activity, things that are in motion, moving forward, and right. It can be studied that way. And so we're looking at it, we're at a moment in our history where you describe the Republicans and how someone like Bannon and some others relate to their constituency in the middle class, make these promises. Of course, you know, the promises get made and broken, and people understand that. We're at a point where we have a crisis of legitimacy among the constituencies, the Republican Party, also the Democratic Party. Democrats are supposed to promise labor all these things, and they've been steadily taking it away since the 1940s, and certainly since the 1980s at an accelerated rate. And so you have among the population a you know, palpable sense that the you know, the structures, the institutions are not responsive to their needs as their needs compound. And I'm wondering, you know, say Bannon can sell this for so long to the Republicans, and the Democrats aren't really selling anything other than Russiagate and Trump to their base. You know, how long can that go on?
Yes, well, that's the that's the big question. A part of me wants to answer you by saying it can't go on very long. But I'm afraid there's another part of me that's a bit more pessimistic and that wonders, you know, as this system fails, as this new tax law, for example, begins to show millions of quote-unquote middle-class Americans that they've just taken another knock on their situation, will Trump and the Republicans and Bannon be able to get them to believe that if they, well, let's take an example, throw every Mexican they can find over the border back into Mexico, this will somehow fix their situation? Well, I remember, my pessimistic side does, many years ago, I think it was the 1960s or early 70s, and I was living at that time and working in New Haven, Connecticut. And it had its share of hippies those days, people who had their hair long and wore certain kinds of styles of clothing and so on. Yeah. And there was some demonstration about something not that controversial. So I was involved in it, and so were a lot of these young people who were, as everyone used to call them, hippies. But at a certain point, I don't remember even why, I stepped out of the line of march near a construction site. And there were a bunch of guys who were construction workers. And they were talking to one another, I'm going to kill those hippies. You know, this sort of mean-spirited, nasty, but said with real passion so that I could understand what they aimed their passion at made no sense, but the passion itself was real enough. Right. So I tried to talk to them since I didn't look like the, you know, I was teaching at Yale and, you know, I didn't look like the folks they were yelling at.
The kids, yeah.
And I said to them, yeah, you know, what is this? And they mumbled, those kids never worked a day in their life, all that kind of stuff. And I said, let me ask you a question. Suppose you really could do it. Suppose you could line up all those young people over there up against the wall and shoot them dead. What do you think it would do to your personal life? At the end of that day, set aside the horror of what you had just done, do you think you would have gotten a better job because you killed them? Do you think you would have gotten more income than you killed? What would it do for you? And they looked at me with total befuddlement.
Right. Never thought it through. Right.
They never worried about that. You know, they fumbled and bumbled. They couldn't come up with anything. They felt a little embarrassed, to be fair to them, that they didn't, you know, and they did recoil at the horror of doing this. They weren't monsters. They weren't about to do that. But I tried, in a way, to learn. It wasn't a rhetorical question. I wanted to get at what in the world is it going to do for you to be hateful towards these people? What? What do you care whether they dress like that? What do you care that they're... And, you know, as we talk, here's the only thing I learned. And I know this sounds strange, but it's what I learned. That in a way, those workers were jealous. What they were jealous of was a stereotype of their own creation. That these young people don't work, that these people don't have any income issues, right, that these people don't have a career for themselves that they're worried about. All things which I, as the teacher of people just like that, knew to be false. Right. But they had constructed people who were free of the work pressure that these guys lived under. And they were jealous and angry that something in those young people's lives exempted them from what these construction workers had no choice but to do. Right. It made me more sympathetic to them, but it also made me aware of how one can turn a legitimate resentment about one's situation into a demonization of a group that is in no way responsible for that situation. Yeah. So will Mr. Trump and Mr. Bannon be able to turn all of their own failures, policy failures, into a Holocaust for immigrants? I don't know. It's certainly something that a good percentage of them are eager to do anyway.
You know, at the bottom of that, I don't know if the students you're talking about were students at Yale. I don't know how.
Some were, yes.
Okay. So, but generally, I would say just that, like any other group, the chunk that you'd pull out of the population, probably a good portion of them are working class. Right. What you have are, you know, members of a class that should be united in order to obtain economic power, if that's what's driving them at the base, and instead at each other's throats, which is kind of the game that's been played, in the game of class warfare from the beginning. Yep. And it's what we saw in the last election, and we see that on the streets today. And it's represented on both sides to this degree. That when you talk about this group of people being irredeemable and this group of people being less than human, which is essentially what all of that boils down to, the prospects for class unity are nil. And absent that, I don't know where anything goes.
Right. That's the beauty of the performance for the system that the Republicans and the Democrats perform. And it can't be said too often. If you focus on everything other than the system itself and its mechanisms for causing trouble, then you are, whether you intend it or not, serving the system, because what you're doing is instructing every critical impulse in the population you deal with to search for the solution anywhere else but system change.
Right.
Because you have got... You're going to focus on one or another real or imagined social ill. You're going to focus on one or another bad politician who has to be removed or a good one who has to be elected. I mean, it never ends.
Right.
The one thing that you cannot do is say, gee, there ought to be a political party out there advocating for why we need system change. And, you know, what that means is that you've trained your population. If you're dissatisfied with whoever is in power, get the other one. There is no other one other than another one who supports capitalism, because that's the way the politics in this country are set up. And this gives you then this illusion, which is all it ever was, an illusion of democratic choice among alternatives, when what you've actually done is taken the most important alternative and made it impossible for that alternative to get a hearing, to get discussed, to be advocated for, or anything else. If I have any hope in this situation, it is that the taboo on an alternative to capitalism, that has been broken. Something has happened in the last 5 years in the United States. And there's a growing disconnect because there are millions and millions of Americans now who do see that the system is the problem and who are now interested in what alternatives exist. And that is the most dangerous thing for the kind of head in the sand mentality that has governed politics since the late 40s.
And finally, one of the things that you've been working on, front and center, is the idea of democratizing the workplace.
Right.
And one of the, things that have been done trying to get from here to there in the condition that we're describing has been for people to start constructing the world that they would like to see. Do you have any suggestions or ideas or some discussion, perhaps, of that whole model?
Right. Well, for me, there's a number of things that make me and people like me focus more and more on the workplace. And let me just rattle off two or three so you can see them. Number one, it brings, if you like, anti-capitalism down to a level where everybody can see what it might mean for him, for her, in their daily life. It stops being what it was in the 20th and 19th century, some grand campaign that changes things at the top of society. It changes the government, changes the relationship between the government and the organization at the top of enterprises, carries out that whole long history of thinking that the alternative to capitalism, where private individuals own and operate enterprises, that the real alternative to that is to have the government, some officials, do that. I think that was a mistake anyway. I think what that did was refuse to face the fact that if socialism or an alternative to capitalism was ever to capture the imagination of the mass of people for very long, it could include changes at the top for sure, but it had to also fundamentally offer a different life all day, every day, to people, to be the kind of meaningful transformation that could get their loyalty, get their commitment, and get their labor to make it happen. So you have to bring, if you like, socialism right down into the household where you live, into the workplace where you work. And talking about a transition from a hierarchical capitalist enterprise, where a tiny group of people at the top, major shareholders and the boards of directors they elect, telling everybody else what to do, literally, and whether they even have a job or have an income or not, is neither necessary nor desirable, especially for people who take democracy seriously, and that you could organize enterprises in a democratic way. Yes, you would get all the usual naysayers who repeat, by the way, for the corporation, exactly what monarchists used to repeat for the kings of this world, that you needed to have these people at the top because a society couldn't work if it didn't have a king at the head of it. And that's no more reasonable than to say that a corporation or a business couldn't work unless there are a tiny number of people making all the key decisions at the top. The second reason I do this is because it puts my enemies off balance, which, if you're going to do this kind of political work, you always have to think about that. The people who've hated alternatives to capitalism, the champions of capitalism, have for 150 years honed their critique of socialists by focusing on the government. Socialists give the government too much power. Socialists make the government intrude on your life. Socialists make the government powerful and rich, and you a lowly subject with nothing, etc., etc. In other words, their critique of socialism is a critique of the state variety, of the kinds of socialism that gave a lot of power, indeed, to the state, etc. By focusing on worker co-ops as the alternative, as the project we're creating, you demobilize your critics. They don't know what to say to you. A worker co-op isn't a scary idea. It is immediately attractive to all kinds of working people, has nothing to do with the state, and therefore is exempt from all of that anti-state stuff that the defenders of capitalism have specialized in. And so it gives me and people like me an extraordinary advantage in talking to people about a change every bit as fundamental as anything socialists have ever done, but in a realm that the critics of socialism have never focused themselves on and really aren't very well equipped to counteract. And finally, what you bring up, we can do it. Even under the existing laws of the United States, which, by the way, vary from state to state, but in many states, not only is it possible for people who want to set up a worker co-op business, but the laws are designed to make it easier than you might imagine. Laws are designed to make the finding of capital, with money with which to start such a business, are easier. And so it is a manageable thing to do. And unlike what happened in the 60s and 70s, where young people who wanted to opt out, and I'm exaggerating here, but, you know, went off to Vermont and to grew organic turnips or something. Right. This is something that doesn't require or even want you to leave the world in which you've grown up. It doesn't want you to leave an urban area for a rural one. It doesn't want you to produce a new or different commodity. I mean, you can do all those things, but it's not necessary, because what you're really doing and what you're celebrating is a new way of relating to one another in the workplace, which is where adults spend most of their lives. And it's going to make that workplace much more pleasurable, much more satisfying, much more of a developmental environment for you to find and to improve skills you didn't even know you had, because you're going to have two job descriptions in every worker co-op. One, the particular task you do in the division of labor, and the other one, your required participation in being on the board of directors, being the worker who is also a leader, a designer, a controller, a director. And that's going to bring you into a new realm of activity, which is going to change your life. And a socialism that promises to change your life directly, whatever happens in the larger society and at the top, is a whole new way of approaching not only what's going wrong in people's lives today, but a whole new way of conceiving an alternative. And I think it's our best chance forward.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello, welcome to Sophie & Co. I'm Sophie Shevardnadze. The war against Islamic State may be entering its final phase in Syria, but a resolution to the country's wider civil conflict is not yet in sight. Will the deadly grind continue, or can the warring parties be finally brought to the table? Well, I ask Nicolaas van Dam, former Dutch special envoy to Syria.
The Islamic State is making its final stand in Syria, shaken by the blows of government and Kurdish forces. The end of the war against the caliphate is in sight, but with the main enemy all but gone, what will happen to the unwritten truce between President Assad and the Syrian rebels? Can the fall of ISIS hasten the end of the Syrian civil war, or will it only serve to prolong the carnage?
Nicolaas van Dam, former Dutch special envoy to Syria, veteran diplomat, author of Destroying a Nation, The Civil War in Syria. Welcome to the show. A great pleasure to have you with us. Mr. Van Dam, Islamic State holds no more than a few small towns in southeast Syria. Stunning reversal from the times when it stretched from Aleppo to Mosul. Now, you might expect ISIS to revert to guerrilla tactics and underground terrorism now. How dangerous will the terror group be after its military is defeated?
Well, they will be underground, so it's more difficult actually to conquer an underground organization. So they will try to do terrorist operations, perhaps not in Syria, but elsewhere in the world.
So when do you think they are going to get resources for that? Where?
Well, that's the point. Since they don't have any oil income, they have less resources, but you don't need much resources to carry out a terrorist attack.
Well, you don't need much resources to carry out a terrorist attack, but you do need resources to keep an organization together. You have to feed the people.
Yes, but I think they will have their cells, or even people who are not really part of the organization are willing to carry out attacks on their own as separate cells.
So the Syrian forces fighting ISIS are taking heavy losses in Deir ez-Zor. Where is Islamic State getting the strength and motivation from to make a tough last stand in their remaining Syrian territory? I mean, why aren't they folding like a house of cards right now?
They are militarily defeated. They are perhaps still stretched out at various desert areas within Syria or perhaps small parts of Iraq. But an organization which doesn't have an army can still carry out all kinds of terrorist attacks all over the world. And as we have seen in Europe, for instance, in Western Europe, there have been various attacks by people who have grown up in Europe. They are not being sent by the so-called Islamic State, but they are already there, and sometimes for various generations.
Why is ISIS more resistant to Assad's troops than the U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces after the fall of Raqqa? The so-called Caliphate struck a truce recently with the SDF, according to the reports from the Inside Syrian Media Center.
Well, I think there it is the same. It depends on, let's say, the Syrian regime wants to attack the Islamic State just as well. But thus far, over the past few years, the Syrian regime has used other forces to eliminate one another. It's a kind of war economy. So sometimes it looked, and the Syrian regime has been accused of coordinating with the Islamic State. But in fact, if that was the case at all, it was just a military strategy to use other forces to eliminate other enemies. And I think that still is going to happen in a province like Idlib in the northwest. There you have the successor of Jabhat al-Nusra, and they will be perhaps attacked by the Americans, by others, by the Turks. So as long as other countries, other armies are doing the work for the Syrian army, it's all right with Damascus. So they use these other forces. Like, for instance, the Kurdish forces in the north, they have received in the past arms of the Syrian regime, not because they were friends of the Syrian regime, but because at that stage, it suited the Syrian regime to use them to attack others and eliminate them. So once these other forces have been eliminated, like the Islamic State, then I think the Syrian regime will turn to other enemies, like the Kurdish armed forces in the north.
Now, it seems like the race to take credit for victory against ISIS is really on. Who can claim to be the ultimate winner here? For instance, French President Macron has already said, "We have won in Raqqa." Does he mean a general victory?
I think it's not any country that really can claim that they have had the victory, because there are so many countries involved in the fight against Daesh, against the Islamic State. It is the Western Alliance, Arab countries, the Syrian regime, the Iranians, the Hezbollah. So to claim it, I think it's a political statement that a politician wants to claim that he or she is the main responsible for winning from Daesh. And it has been a process of various years.
What does the end of ISIS mean for the local groups on the ground in Syria? I mean, are the Syrian Kurds and Assad's forces going to go against each other once the common caliphate enemy is no more? Or will we see a de facto partition of Syria between the Kurds and Arabs?
I think nobody wants a partition of Syria, but the problem is everyone wants to have the power in Syria. So the big question now is that once Daesh or IS is eliminated or defeated militarily, and the regime troops and the opposition troops are confronting one another with the help of, on the one side, Russia and Iran, and on the other side by the Americans, how much the Americans are still prepared to support the people they were supporting before, or whether after Daesh has been defeated they will lose their interest and they don't want, I think, at all any confrontation with Russia in Syria. And probably also not the other way around.
Yeah, there's all this talk of a future political transition in Syria and how Assad may be gone after a peace deal is hammered out. Now we keep hearing about the opposition and what they want, but what should we do with those who fight for Assad? Are they going to just accept something they fought so hard to prevent?
Well, I think the main forces in Syria fighting for Assad on behalf of Assad or supporting him are Russia and Hezbollah and Iran. And none of them wants to lose their allies, so they will keep supporting they will keep supporting the regime because they don't want to lose a strategic ally.
What about, you know, Syrians who are certainly partially, not all of Syria, but a lot of people in Syria are still supporting Assad? What about them?
Well, they will all wait until there is a new situation in which Syria is peaceful. So they will keep supporting the regime, and many others are opposing the regime. And the negotiations, or you can better call it the intra-Syrian talks in Geneva, as long as both sides still want to eliminate one another, the opposition wants Assad to leave at least, and although they say we have no preconditions, and the Syrian regime in fact wants to get rid of the opposition. So the Syrian regime, militarily speaking, is getting more and more strong. And the country, militarily speaking, and the party that is stronger, militarily speaking, the more it is strong, the less they are willing to really make any concessions.
You know, after Assad's visit to Russia, Vladimir Putin discussed peace in Syria with Donald Trump. Do you think Washington and Moscow can really come to a consensus in Syria? I mean, seeing how their relations in all the other areas just abysmal?
I think the relationship between Moscow and Damascus and the United States and Damascus is fully asymmetric. Russia is a friend of President al-Assad, and the Americans are in fact his enemy and have not only during the Civil War, but during this war, but also in the past had very negative relations. So it will be very difficult to have a real compromise between the United States and Russia,
if you have noticed, Mr. Rendam, for the past half year or so, Americans aren't so adamant about Assad leaving as a precondition to anything anymore, because they do understand in order to have some sort of peace settlement in Syria, they need Assad right now. And I don't think Russia is actually insistent on Assad staying once the peaceful transition is done. I don't think that Assad as a person is the sole important thing for Russia.
No, Assad is not at all important as a person, but he is important in as far as his leaving would cause a risk in the regime falling apart. So, indeed, the Americans are much less adamant to have him leave, although from time to time they keep saying it again. So, in the end, I think most countries are accepting that he will stay. And there is talk that he would have to leave at the beginning of the transitional period. But there must at first be a transitional period at all, because for the regime, transition is a kind of dirty word almost, that they don't want any transition. At most, they want any reform or so. But as long as they stay in power for the regime, it's okay. But gradually, also from the Gulf states, also from Qatar and Saudi Arabia and others, and for Turkey, all those countries which first want him to leave, not only to leave, but topple him, they have now come to other opinions, because they got, particularly Turkey also, they got a lot of damage or disadvantage from their support of the opposition, because this gave the Kurdish forces a chance to occupy a big part of northern Syria.
All right, Mr. Van Damme, we're going to take a short break right now. When we're back, we'll continue talking to Nicolas Van Dam, former Dutch special envoy to Syria, ex-ambassador to Egypt and Iraq, and we'll talk about how the Syrian civil war is going to play out in the near future. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
And we're back with Nicolas Van Dam, former Dutch special envoy to Syria, discussing the situation on the ground in the war-torn country. Welcome back, Mr. Van Dam. Now, the United States has a lot more troops on the ground in Syria than they care to admit, and it seems that there is no plan for any immediate withdrawal. What will the American military presence mean for the final act of the Syrian war when it comes?
It is really fully open-ended whether or not the Americans want to stay there and confront the Syrian regime and the Russians. I very much doubt it, that they really want to continue this war, which has almost already taken 7 years, and to continue military actions against whom? So if they would be, they might defend the opposition, but I don't think they are going to attack in any way the Syrian regime. They may be using these forces to eliminate extremist forces in Idlib province, for instance, together with the Turks, together with others. But I don't think they are willing anymore at all to fight the regime. So it will be a cleaning up operation against terrorist extremist forces. But this is both in the interest of the regime and both in the interest of the moderate forces of the opposition.
You mentioned Turkey, and I want to talk a bit about it. The country has recently established another Syrian foothold. Do you think Ankara is just going to keep its troops on Syrian territory for as long as it pleases? Are they playing a stabilizing role here? What's your take?
I think the main thing for Turkey is to get rid of any powerful position of the PYD, the Kurdish party, which is in power there, and the PKK. So if they can eliminate or neutralize the role of the Kurds in Syria, then for them it's okay, I think. And then, of course, if Turkey suffers from terrorist attacks, which would emanate from northern Syria, they want to attack those as well, these forces. But I don't think the Turks, I think they will already have regretted that they've intervened at all, because if they had not intervened, probably the Kurdish factor would now be that strong. So I think in the end, they are going to cooperate with the regime to eliminate the Kurdish forces in the north. This is a common interest. But it's quite a switch from wanting to eliminate or to topple the regime of President Bashar al-Assad together with other forces, and then come back and cooperate with him against the Kurdish forces, which have achieved quite a lot of independence now.
What is Saudi Arabia, which is accused of sponsoring rebels across the region, going to do about its al-Qaeda protégés being defeated? Will they just abandon them?
I think the Saudis, they are much more focused on the role of Iran than on any other force. So they want to diminish the strength of Iran for strategic reasons. And for that, they have now also a kind of link with Israel, which also wants Iran to be eliminated from Syria territory. So I think the Saudis, at first they wanted to topple the regime, and I think now they accept it. But they are much more interested in the strategic issue from Syria, because they didn't have any problem with Syria in the past. But since, let's say, the American occupation of Iraq and the aftermath, the Iranians have enormously gained ground in the whole region, in Iraq, in Syria, in Lebanon. So I think that is the main preoccupation. So all those countries that interfered militarily, directly or indirectly in Syria, they had side effects which were very unfavorable towards them, and now they are concentrating on these factors to eliminate them. So for the Turkey, this is the Kurds, and for the Saudis, this is Iran.
So since we're talking about all the players involved, and you mentioned Iran, Iranian-sponsored manpower is crucial to Assad's success. All those advisors, militias, etc. If Assad stays in power and eventually wins the war, is that going to give Iran virtual mastery over Syria? Will Assad have to become Iran's client?
I don't think so, in the sense that also Assad wouldn't want those forces, those foreign forces on his country, except in a kind of way, like, for instance, Russia having a military base or so, but not to dominate the regime. It is not what he wants at all. They helped him, but once he will be back in power over the whole of Syria, then he doesn't want them anymore. But the Iranians have their interests towards Israel, of course. So they want to have a kind of military base in Syria to attack or defend against Israel. But the Israelis don't want this at all. So in a way, the Iranians will have to withdraw when they're not anymore needed. And this is, I think, the countries that support the regime, they cannot simply dictate to President Bashar al-Assad what they want him to do, because it's a mutual thing. They want to keep their so-called client, their ally, but their ally, the Syrian ally, is not simply going to do what their supporter is saying if they feel that it's not in their interest.
In Iraq, the Kurdish population is in a face-over lands won back from the ruins of ISIS. Kirkuk is in Baghdad's hands, but it is restless, and it all comes on the back of a recent independence referendum. Can a post-ISIS war break out in Iraq over the Kurdish question?
Well, there is inside Iraq. Well, I think, in my opinion, the Kurdish Democratic Party, or the, let's say, under leadership of Barzani, during the referendum, they claimed all Kurdistan, which was having an autonomy, but also the parties, the controversial areas, which they conquered in the interest of battling ISIS. But, for instance, Kirkuk has also been very controversial. So I think as long as the Kurds, under the leadership of Barzani or anyone else, stay within that territory which had the official Kurdish autonomy, I don't think there's any reason for war. But, and they have withdrawn, so I think there's not any reason for war anymore. But if they would have stayed within, not just because of the oil, but also, it's also important, but if they would have stayed in Kirkuk and refused to leave, then it would really be a reason for war. But that reason has now been lifted, or has been eliminated by their withdrawal.
So the Iranian-Saudi rivalry is what's shaping the Middle East lately. Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri quit his post very abruptly while in Saudi Arabia. Some say he was kidnapped. The Saudis claimed that Lebanon declared war on them. Then Hariri returned, is now prime minister again. Really bizarre turn of events that included visits to Paris, Cyprus, Egypt. What's going on here? Is this all connected to the Iran-Saudi standoff?
Well, I think what he said, what the prime minister of Lebanon said, was that he had problems with Hezbollah. And Hezbollah, being part of the Lebanese political equation, is dominant, but it has much bigger military power than, for instance, the Lebanese army. I don't think, as far as I've been able to follow, that Hezbollah has a role in wanting to dominate the whole of Lebanon. That would be very unwise. But it can be that in the perception of Saudi Arabia, they want a much bigger role in Lebanon than they want them to have. And this is all interlinked, Iran, Saudi Arabia,
yeah,
Hezbollah,
but
the corridor, yes?
Right, but if you're saying that Hezbollah being a large part of the Lebanese political establishment equation is the problem, then we see Hariri being back, being prime minister. Should we assume that the problem is gone? It's dealt with?
Well, the problem or the issue of Hezbollah being very, very powerful militarily, as long as they don't threaten the government of Lebanon, there's nothing that bad for the government.
Is the Saudi-led blockade of Qatar part of the Saudi-Iranian Cold War as well? Is Qatar going to cave in or move to Iran's camp pushed by Saudi hostility?
Well, I think that the Gulf states in general, the Gulf Cooperation Council states, they have taken a role which is very anti-Iranian. And some states like Qatar, but also Oman, they have a more open relationship with Iran. And this is very much rejected by Saudi Arabia. But I think if you have a conflict, it applies to many conflicts, and you want to solve anything, it's better to have some relations, if not good relations, than just to have hostile relations. And I think in this respect, Qatar is playing a sort kind of intermediary role. And because of the exclusion by the other Gulf Cooperation states, Qatar has moved more in the direction of Iran because of this. Oman is a case apart because they have relatively good relations. But I think this whole attitude against Iran could be a little bit, could be changed. I mean, from enmity, animosity, hostility towards a more reconciliatory attitude. But one of the Saudi princes once told me that the Saudis have in their DNA a kind of hostility towards Iran.
Oh, well, we'll see how it all plays out. Mr. Van Dam, thank you very much for this interview. We were talking to Nicolas Van Dam, former Dutch special envoy to Syria, veteran diplomat, about the civil war in Syria and the waves it's sending across a wider Middle East. That is it for the latest edition of Sophie & Co. I'll see you next time.
Thank you.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.